Fly Fishing Rocky Mountain National Park podcast reference series, helping you get the most out of your fly fishing experience in the park. Whether you've fished the park many times or you're planning your very first trip, the reference series podcast will certainly have something to make your next trip more successful and memorable. Hi, I'm Steve Schweitzer, author of A Fly Fishing Guide to Rocky Mountain National Park. Let's get right to today's podcast.
In today's episode, I have a very special guest with me, Josh Rickard. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good, good. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about entomology in the park. There's a wide, diverse array of bugs in the park. It's literally a bug factory. Josh, I know that you've spent years studying bugs in the park. Why don't you tell me a little bit about how you got into that?
Well, it was just a kind of a side project trying to become a better fisherman. I probably, like most people, was reading magazines, reading books, and you hear the terms BWO and you see the stone flies. And I really just started wondering, you know, all these flies I'm using, what am I really imitating? So it just started off as kind of a curiosity thing, just was next to the river and would pick up a stone and see what was underneath it and go, oh, that's pretty cool. And then that would produce kind of confidence from understanding that, oh, okay, this bug matches this fly, and that's why I'm catching fish. And so I kept improving my fishing. So I actually stopped by Walmart one time and then picked up the little dollar aquarium net and started digging it around in the stream and kept finding more and more bugs, and it kept improving my fishing. And then I upgraded to a homemade seine net so that I could actually go to the stream and, you know, get in there and really kick up the big rocks and the dirt and see what I found. And every time I did that, I'd find something new. I would improve my flies. I'd improve my confidence that my flies would work. And so it just kept steamrolling from there.
Yeah. You've got quite a collection, quite a vast knowledge of information. In fact, you put a lot of this information, including photos and the details of your findings, on your website, RockyMountainFlyFisher.com.
Right. And a lot of those pictures there, even the big stone flies that you'll see and that we'll talk about today, you'll find those in the park. And it's even surprising how many people locally don't even know that that stuff is there. It's fun to go out on the river, collect some bug samples, and come back to the shop. And I've got a Tupperware that I've stolen from the house full of stone flies.
Right.
And people are going like, oh my God, you know, I was out fishing a size 14 and that was, I needed a size 8.
You know, studying from a scientific perspective isn't new to you. You have a background in science. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
In high school, I kind of developed an interest in chemistry. And then when I went to school up at Colorado State, I got a major in chemical engineering. So I just love science fields and learning and how things interact and why they work. And so connecting that, you know, the bugs there and why flies work has kind of been a fun thing to do for me.
Absolutely. Well, I know you're an avid fly fisherman, so that doesn't hurt to put this hobby and marry them together.
It's a lot of fun. So
we're right in the middle of the summer here as we record this. We've had a lot of snow and a lot of runoff this year in 2011. It's kind of altered the bug season a little bit, at least in the early part. Why don't you take us through the types of bugs that you'd find in the park?
Well, I think a lot of people sometimes, just as an overview, take the quality of the park for granted in a way. When it comes to bugs, it's a beautiful park. It's pristine. The waters are clean. They're full of nutrients, and the rocky nature of the streams actually introduces a lot of oxygen into the streams, and that actually creates an awesome bug habitat. So when you're actually coming out here, you get all the different types of bugs that you normally see. You get the classic stone flies, the mayflies, the caddis, and the midges. So the range of bugs in the streams and that the fish are seeing on a constant basis in the drift is actually pretty diverse.
Yeah. You know, one thing the park is known for is dry fly fishing.
Yes.
Particularly in the summer, hoppers and ants and beetles and, large attractor mayfly patterns.
Right.
But the park's really not known for stoneflies or, aquatic beetles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. They're just, with the diverse of insects, you're actually missing a lot a lot of people are missing a lot of opportunities to hook up with more fish. There is nothing better, and I'm not even going to argue about a fish coming up and slamming your dry fly. Yeah. And it's just a whole bunch of fun. I mean, it's one of the reasons we fish. But imitating some of these other insects and getting your nymphs down and varying your patterns can actually produce a lot of success. Now, you talked about people fishing dry flies for caddis, grasshoppers, and terrestrials and insects. And one of the reasons that works so well, and some big dry fly patterns actually work all year from, say, June to October, is because it's just the diverse fly populations. There's always a big bug hatching. So even before the hoppers are out, there's stone flies hatching, both the salmon flies, then the golden stones, and there's a big caddis up in the park, the great gray spotted sedge, that just continues right after them. And so the fish are constantly used to seeing very big dry flies, even up to size 10s and 8s, on a fairly consistent basis. And then you have the hoppers come around, and then as they die off, you have the October caddis pick up. So it's just, there's always big bugs on the surface, so it helps create that great dry fly fishing.
Yeah, and it's good for the trout, particularly because they have such a short growing season,
mm-hmm.
That when it does become ice off, there's always some sort of big food morsel around that kind of tease them, something that we can imitate and fish.
Right, and also because of that short season, is sometimes where in lower elevations, the hatches may be a little more distinct periods. They can overlap a lot sometimes. So yeah. You don't necessarily have to have, you know, in June, these three exact bugs, because some of the later spring bugs might carry over and the early summer bugs might carry over. So yeah,
absolutely. Let's drill down a little bit on stoneflies. When would I expect to see stoneflies start in the park, and when do they kind of end, and what stoneflies would I happen to see?
If you're looking for stoneflies, you're going to see stoneflies year-round, almost. As soon as the ice starts coming off, there's the little winter stoneflies that you can actually see in the snow. For most people, that might be a little early season. So the first stonefly they probably will see will actually be the classic salmon fly. And not a lot of people know that, you know, they think Montana, they think the big Colorado River on the west slope, or other places around where it's very well known. They don't realize that right here in our mountains, even, there is a small salmon fly hatch. So, you know, if you come out early, be ready. You might hit it.
That's April, early May.
April, May, sometimes into June. I mean, just depending on the year. Yeah. This year is a little later, I think, it happens, so just because of the high water and the runoff.
Yeah.
But then that tailors right into the golden stone hatch.
Yeah.
And that is one of the probably the most important stoneflies, I think, in the park. And it goes up to a pretty surprisingly high elevation. You can find golden stoneflies up to almost 10,000 feet sometimes.
Yeah.
I was actually, me and a buddy had hiked on a trail and decided to take one of the off-trail streams, and we fished up. And I got my fly stuck on a log, and I reached out and picked it up, and the bark broke off. And this is in July. And sitting in my hand was probably an inch and a half golden stonefly. And I'll tell you what, I'm sure those fish were looking up at that point.
Yeah, I have seen more golden stones than any other type of stone in the park. That doesn't mean I'm not particularly looking for stoneflies, but I think that's a really undervalued food resource to fish.
Probably the number one fly underfished in the park.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. Then after the golden stonefly, what would you expect to see?
If we're sticking with stoneflies, you'll start moving into a huge kind of group. And as fishermen, we can lump these all together. For those of you who are into entomology or biologists out there, you know, you might cringe a little bit at this, but there's these kind of overlapping summer hatches that we all refer to as yellow sallies.
Yeah.
And they'll kind of vary in color from yellow, obviously, to slightly orange to even a little green.
Yeah.
So, and they're a little smaller, but again, they create great dry fly action. They're a constant food source for the trout. So, you know, again, why dry fly fishing is great in the park and why those trout can get very healthy.
Those flies, by the way, when they're yellow and green, they're very difficult to see in the summer. even when they're flying. They just tend to just blend in with the colors around you, the green mm-hmm. and yellow leaves and the streamside shrubbery. And not unless you are looking for them will you really expect to see them. In fact, you and I last year did a hike. We were fishing roughly, I think, 9,800 to 10,000 feet, mm-hmm. somewhere in that range. So not particularly super high for the park, but it's above where the crowds go.
Oh, yeah.
And we were definitely off trail, and I saw these little green stoneflies crawling all over the place. Mm-hmm. I didn't particularly have any patterns that day that would imitate that. I didn't expect to bring that. But it made me think twice about what I should put in my box as I go up in those high-altitude streams, because you're right, those little stoneflies are up at pretty good altitudes.
They are, and the easiest way to see if they're around, too, and this is probably a habit that every fly fisherman needs to get into more, and I definitely do, but you're spending all day right next to those willowy branches and those trees, right streamside. Just take 5 seconds, reach over, and give it a shake and see what pops out.
Yeah.
And that'll give you a really good indication about what the trout are seeing.
Yeah.
So you can pick your flies accordingly.
Yeah, that's a great tip. So after the yellow sallies, are there any other stoneflies worth mentioning?
As far as stoneflies go, that pretty much covers what's important to the fishermen. But it's probably a pretty good time to mention actually an interesting caddisfly that's in the park that takes up right after late into the fall, which is that October caddis, which is another fly not a lot of people know we have. But your big stonefly patterns that you were fishing for the yellow sallies and maybe some of the goldens, just leave them in your box because that's a great imitation for that October caddis.
Oh, that's a great tip.
So
absolutely.
No need to switch flies. Just understand you're imitating a different bug.
Yeah. So going into caddis, that's a great segue. Kind of jumping back into spring. So we've covered essentially April through October for stoneflies. Let's cover the same time period for caddis, and let's talk a little bit about what pops out in the park starting in April, May time frame.
The first probably really major caddis is the Mother's Day caddis. And when I was getting into entomology and trying to just learn what was in my local streams, that was one of those ones that surprised me, because locally in Colorado, the famous Mother's Day caddis is the Arkansas. And so, you know, everybody travels there, and you know, you hear the reports of it, and you're going like, well, golly, I'm not going to hit the Mother's Day caddis hatch this year. Well, okay, it may be really, really big over there, but in Rocky Mountain National Park and the surrounding streams, there is Mother's Day caddis. Yeah. So that all your patterns that you're fishing for those kind of streams and other places are perfect for the park.
Yeah, and that occurs around Mother's Day, which is in the May time frame.
Right, it can come early, it can come late, but yeah. that's the first major hatch.
Yeah, so typically April in the park, things are still thawing out. There's still some snow. Mm-hmm. Probably wouldn't expect to find too many caddis at that point in time.
Probably not as many. Yeah. You're still looking at mostly nymphing. The big stones are still active. And that's one of the points we could detour on here real quick. When you're looking at the hatch chart in the book or anywhere you go, if you see a bug, like for example, we'll take the salmon fly. Okay, it hatches in June, but April and May, they're as big as they're going to get. And they're crawling around, they're getting ready to get active and hatch. So just because they're not hatching in the park at that time, it's a great pattern to pull out and maybe try something new that you normally wouldn't. So those big stonefly patterns, maybe one of those good times to get them out and try to go after some of those big browns that are hiding around.
Absolutely. That's a great detour, by the way. You know, when you look at a hatch chart, I don't care where you are in the United States or around the world, when you look at a hatch chart, it's a hatch chart. Mm-hmm. It means when you're going to see the flying or crawling version of that insect, when the most activity of that insect occurs. Mm-hmm. The couple months prior to that, as you suggest, they are very active, but they're aquatic. And they're crawling around and they're preparing for their emergence.
Right.
That's a perfect time to nymph those things. And, you know, we all know from reading and our experience in fly fishing that 90% of the time trout are feeding on the nymphal stage or an emergence stage of a fly.
So, right.
We're in May now. Now we're going to go into June. Things are starting to warm up. The water's starting to peak in terms of typical runoff. What would we find then?
Actually, and it's back to that point of on nymphing, is that right around June, there's big drifts of October caddis. this is a time of year where even though they're going to hatch in the fall, they have this instinct to come out of their shucks and drift around. And so you have these big, roughly just under an inch, 3/4 of an inch size larvae, tan caddisflies drifting around. This is their drift time. So it may not be a dry fly situation for these guys, but it's another big food source for trout at this time.
And what keys that, do you know?
You know, water, sunlight, just who knows, but it's just a great phenomena that we can key in on as fly fishermen, just knowing, again, that October caddis are present in the park.
Yeah, that's another great tip for the fly fisher traveling in June here.
Yes.
So after that occurs, we're coming into July, which is mm-hmm. the time period we're recording right now.
Yes.
What would we expect to find?
Well, we're just seeing the great gray spotted sedge hatch kind of ending. And this is actually a big caddisfly, not quite as big as the October caddis and not quite as big as the golden stones that hatched just before, but it's another big caddisfly that's hatching. And, they're size 14s up to 12, size dry fly. So it's a big bug on top.
Yeah.
So, and then as we move forward from here, going into the summer, you get into the classic, just tons of different caddis overlapping, hatching, and if you're a fly fisherman can actually tell the difference between those two, besides that one's brown and that one's green, then, good for you. But, right back to that tip, shake the bushes as you're walking through, see what color the caddis are, and you just match them up, because it's going to be varied, and there's going to be a lot of them.
Yeah.
So
even when I don't see caddis in the middle of the hot summer days mm-hmm. where we have low water situations, I'll still fish a caddis dry. I've just found it to be very effective. It may imitate a small hopper of some sort, may imitate a caddis, but there are caddis year-round.
Yes.
Well, during
the fishing season.
Ice out, the fishing season. During ice out to ice in that year-round. There's some sort of caddis always pop.
And one kind of fun entomology thing that's slightly important to the fly fisher is that one of the reasons caddis tend to stick around a little more is they can actually drink water. When they hatch, the adults don't lose their mouth parts. So even though the adults may be done mating, they'll stick around in the bushes and hang out and still get knocked on the water. Versus, ironically, the mayfly, which when it hatches, it only has a couple days. And one of the reasons that is it can't drink water.
Hmm.
So that's why sometimes a caddis may be a little more productive, even though they're not physically hatching at that time.
Well, I learn something new all the time. that's great to know. So we've talked about the summer season with caddis, and we've talked a little bit about the October caddis, which could take us clear into November if the temperature is right. Are there any other caddis that we should be aware of?
As far as covering the park, that's pretty much the major caddis species. But you hit on a pretty good point right there that sometimes that hatch does go into November.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories from guys where it's kind of getting late season in the park. They miss kind of fishing some of their favorite hopper patterns or bigger flies, and they'll put one on. And, just for fun, and, that's part of the reason we fish, is just to have a great time.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, fish are hitting this big fly in November.
Yeah.
And they come back and they're scratching their heads and it's like, those fish don't know what they're doing or something. But no, I mean, there's a reason for it. It's that October caddis hanging around for a little longer.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed as we've talked thus far, you're not using taxonomy. You're not using Latin names to discuss these bugs. And I personally appreciate it. I don't memorize that stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've learned one thing in my studies of doing this is that fish don't understand Latin. So if it's not important to them, it's not important to me.
Yeah.
And in a lot of this, as fly fishermen, we can lump these things into big groups of flies because one fly, for example, might cover a variety different of species. And if you actually started to drill down in the species-specific bug, the list would just be huge. I mean, there's hundreds of different species in the park.
Yeah.
And even to identify those, if you're reading through some of the literature, it's like, under your microscope, look at the forward, some word, I'm not sure, and I'm going like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Right.
And it just doesn't seem to add anything to the fly fishing. And in communicating with each other, you know, if I started talking Latin to everybody here right now, we'd probably lose half our audience anyway. So.
Well, definitely, you know, in the back of the book, I do put the taxonomy identification for these bugs. But honestly, that was part of research. It's not something I know. But I do know them from a seasonal type of bug, you know, a spring sedge versus October caddis. You know, that's how I identify them. And I think most of us identify that as well as a fly fisher.
Right.
So let's transition into talking about mayflies, a very popular fly to fish in the park from a fly tying standpoint. But what exactly are we imitating with the many mayflies, you know, the Adams and the Royal Wolfs and the PMDs? Take us through the mayfly season.
Well, one of the great things about the park, again, is those cold, clear, clean streams. And when you're talking about health of streams, there's two bugs that are very important. The stoneflies, which we've kind of covered, and the mayflies. If you have polluted waters or waters that are low in oxygen or some other thing where the stream is starting to degrade in quality a little bit, those are the first two things that disappear in your streams. And fortunately, we are in beautiful country, clean country, wonderful country, and so we get great populations of mayflies. So if you're starting in spring, you get your classic blue wing olive hatches, and those can be imitated by your standard pheasant tails and other kind of smaller nymph patterns and small dry flies. As runoff starts going down and you move into summer, we actually have another surprising bug that not a lot of people realize, and we have the big green drakes that are present in the park. And they are crawling around everywhere, especially in the lower sections of the park. And so you have another big bug coming off kind of early summer that you can just key in on with your big Adams and humpies and all those kind of fun things that the fish will see. Then you get into kind of these overlapping hatches, and they can all be lumped together in one big group. And in common fishing terms, it's probably called the rusty spinners. Most of them are red and kind of brown, which actually leads to a misnomer here in our little local communities, where you see a lot of fishing reports go, oh, the brown drakes are out. Well, everywhere else in the country, in kind of common fly fishing term, a brown drakes refers to this burrowing mayfly nymph, and that just isn't here. So if you're coming from somewhere else in the country and you're seeing reports of brown drakes, don't bring your brown drake nymphs. If trout are picking them off, they're picking them off as something else, but we don't have those. Yeah. Our mayflies here are the swimmer types, and the clinger types are mostly in the park.
Yeah, exactly. There's not a lot to burrow into.
No, it's Rocky Mountain National Park for a reason. Okay. The most surprising mayfly in the park, there's one. It looks like a bigger blue wing olive, so it's long, slender, roughly about a size 14. And this one is not well known among a lot of people. And if you look at one, it actually is banded, kind of like a grizzly hackle. It goes red, black, red, black down the backside of it, or kind of a black, brownish red, black, brownish red. And it is this little swimming mayfly. And anytime there's roots hanging in to the river or other vegetation, these things gather and dart around, and their movement is described as minnow-like. And so they're all darting around under there, and the interesting thing about it is it doesn't hatch like a classic mayfly. It actually crawls out of the water like a stonefly.
Oh, wow.
It's the only one I've known so far in our area that does this, and it doesn't have an emergent stage in the stream. But what it does do is this nice darting mayfly, good size for trout to come and snatch and eat. The convenient thing for the fly fisherman is that the dry fly falls right in with the rusty spinners.
Yeah.
So your kind of brownish red rusty spinner that you're fishing for those spinner falls is going to do perfectly for that fly.
Yeah.
But the important thing maybe to try there is that size little 14 pheasant tail that you have sitting in your box makes a great point fly during the summer for multiple reasons. Absolutely. And that's another reason that fly works so well.
Put that as a dropper.
Mm-hmm.
You bet. So mayflies, now we talk a lot about mayflies in streams.
Yes.
As we work our way up in altitude, would you find mayflies or even kind of, maybe you can digress and even caddisflies and stoneflies we talked about, mm-hmm. in lakes?
As you move up in elevation, it seems like the first thing that starts dropping out in the water column is the caddisflies. They get less and less common, whereas in the lower elevations and the lower you go, they tend to get more common. The swimming mayflies start disappearing. It starts getting very rocky, very high gradients, so there's less places for them to swim around, and if they do swim around, they get washed downstream very quickly.
Yeah.
So you get very good populations of clinging mayflies, and those are actually a pretty good size. I've seen them up to a size almost 12.
Oh, wow.
So there's still some big bugs up there, and of course chasing them is those golden stones we alluded to.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually those stoneflies will start disappearing, and when you start getting to your upper lakes, you're pretty much left with things like blue-wing olives as mayflies and your classic midges.
Yeah.
So when you get up there, you can really simplify your box a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
let's talk a little bit about midges, since mm-hmm. it sounds like a good segue into that being our fourth category of bugs that we're going to talk about here.
Yes. The first kind of common misconception about midges is that they're kind of a winter, early and late season bug. That's when a lot of people fish them. I mean, they're still emerging in the winter. And then as they move into summer, they tend to drop out. But that's actually a mistake in a way. There's other bugs hatching, and sometimes fish will focus on the other bugs since they're bigger and more dominant. But midges are a year-round hatch, constantly going. And in the peak of summer, you can have an adult midge emerge, lay an egg, and 7 days later, that egg will have hatched into the next generation.
Wow.
They're very fast.
7 days.
7 days is the optimum they can do, it seems like. So always having a midge pattern in your box, ready to fish, is a great idea. There's lots of great midge patterns to pick in the book, and so you can almost go nuts. In the upper lakes, upper lakes in the park, it's a major food source. And they're not always necessarily small either. Sometimes during the summer, you think you're swatting some big mosquitoes, and if you actually look, you're swatting a big midge.
Yeah.
So not necessarily a midge has to be a size, 22, 26 type bug. You can get away with sometimes a size 16 or larger in a couple rare situations.
So other than stoneflies, caddisflies, mayflies, and midges, are there other aquatic species that we should be concerning ourselves with as fly fishers?
Oh, of course. The first big one is crane flies. It's a big grubby worm. Sometimes very big sizes, up to inch and a half long, and they get in those muddy banks. Flows come up, flows come down. The rain happens. They get into the stream a little more, and fish will key right in on those. The other kind of interesting thing is that if you're seining in the river and looking for things, you start getting these little green caterpillar-like things, and what they actually are is aquatic beetle larvae. Or even just beetle larvae, really. And they're just this bright green. And for the fishermen, you don't need a new pattern for those. You can just use any of your green kind of free-living caddis patterns, and that'll duplicate it very well. But what that means is the streamside vegetation there has the adults, which are the beetles coming back and landing on the water and releasing their eggs or diving down into the stream to lay their eggs.
Yeah.
And so that's why one of the reasons that a lot of fishermen do very well on beetle patterns, because there's beetles that use the stream to lay their eggs. And if you listen to the last podcast, too, they hinted about a special pink fly that is getting a lot of notoriety around here. And a lot of fishermen have problems fishing that, and I think it has to do with the W word in that name.
San Juan worm happens to be pink.
We refer to those as the long aquatic thin things. And what fishermen need to realize is they're not bait fishing. The fish aren't taking that as earthworms being washed into the stream being down. There's actually great populations throughout here of aquatic worms. And if you actually took these worms out of the stream and on the dry land, that would kill them, kind of like taking an earthworm and putting it in the stream drowns it. It's flipped.
Yeah.
So as flows move, as these things dig around and find themselves caught in the current, it's a great food source for trout. It's a good protein, and they're going to pick them up.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've covered four major bug types, aquatic bugs. Let's talk a little bit about terrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably one of my favorite things to fish in the park. You know, we've got beetles, ants, hoppers primarily.
Right. And you have the beetles that we covered. You know, a lot of those are they're there for a reason. They're not your normal beetles that are just kind of crawling around randomly. I mean, some might be, but they're there next to the stream because they need it in their life cycle. Hoppers, I mean, is there anything funner than fishing hoppers?
Very little.
They get blown into the stream constantly. They're on the stream side vegetation. You walk by, they clearly hop in any direction with no sense of where they're going, and some of that time they're going to be in the stream. So fish have to focus in on those. Ants, all those bushes, all those overhanging branches. I mean, who probably has it in the park? You know, put their hand on a tree, and next thing you know, you got ants on yourself.
Yeah.
They're running around. They've got to collect things for the winter. They've got that short growing season. The wind kicks up, it drops them right in. They make a bad step, they're in too.
Yeah.
And it's a great protein source for fish, and that's exactly what they're keying in on.
Yeah. Now, I've read many times over in numerous resources that the ant is the most dense biomass on the earth, that there are more ants per square meter on average in the earth than any other insect. And as I walk through the park, even in April when there's still snow, if it's a warm day, that tends to just spark their movement. Now, they're moving slow, but I see ants. As soon as that ground opens up and they can get out from either behind a bark on the tree where they've wintered over or in the ground where they've wintered over, if they can get out, they're going to start crawling around.
They get very active, they get very busy, and so maybe even not a large percent of them end up in the stream, but just because there's so many with so much activity,
yeah,
it puts a good number of them in the stream, which fish are going to key in on.
Yeah.
We were hiking around last year, and in the stream, we were looking, and sure enough, there were ants drifting down in the current.
Absolutely.
So,
in fact, I fished an ant probably 75-80% of the time last summer, a dry fly.
Mm-hmm.
And it just became my go-to pattern. I just kept it on the rod. I'd come home, put my rod away, fully strung in the garage. It had an ant on it. I'd pick it right back up, go back and mm-hmm. fish it because I was lazy and I didn't want to put anything else on. Frankly, I didn't have to.
No, and those ant patterns, especially a lot of the ones you have in the book, not only look like ants to trout, but they're going to look like other things too. Like they might take them as a beetle imitation or some other dry fly, as it creates an impression.
Absolutely.
It's a great pattern.
So let's talk a little bit about how you fish the park. You know, you have an expansive knowledge of bugs, so it kind of gives you an edge on fishing. Let's say you're going into Moraine Park for a day, which is a mm-hmm. popular destination for many of our listeners. How would you approach the moraine, and what would you take in your fly box?
Well, the first thing you have to remember about the moraine is that, and this is the biggest reason too, I think entomology is important, it gives you confidence in your flies. And when you have confidence in your flies, you correct what I consider probably the big reasons why you're not catching fish, which the moraine is a classic example of what most fishermen do. It's a wide open area. There's not a lot of cover. You're excited. You run up to the stream bank. You've just spooked every fish in the hole because they saw you. And so you're fishing, and now you're changing your pattern 20 different times when the problem's not the pattern, the problem's the fisherman. So kind of on a tangent of that is that I think understanding that these patterns that the fish are seeing a lot of different insects at any given time is important, because it helps you go, well, okay, I need to slow my approach. I need to make sure I'm not spooking the fish I want to catch. So the marine park is the classic example of that. So whenever I'm going to a marine park, the first thing I do, I get out of the car, I take a deep breath, I slow myself down, because that's going to be your number one fish non-catch issue.
Yeah.
So, but as far as flies go, I this has also been the trend in my fly fishing lately. I'm starting to move to bigger and bigger flies. Early in the season, we did a kick up of the park, or marine park, and I'll tell you what, there were some beautiful golden stones, and the green drakes are looking, I mean, healthy.
Yeah.
Great population. So if I was walking into marine park, say, when we hang up this podcast and I talk you into going fishing or something, the first thing I'm going to put in my box.
Well, let's go.
Yeah, we're out of here. The first thing I'm going to do is pick select a good nymph pattern that kind of imitates several different things. And so right now with the green drakes getting ready to hatch soon, and some of the other larger mayflies starting to get active and moving around, especially with the high water kicking them off, I'm probably going to pick a good size, a large extended 16 hook or a 14, kind of nice greeny leggy pattern, something with some action, because those flies, they have a lot of movement on them. They get kicked up in the drift and those legs stretch out, the gills start flexing. So I pick a pattern that can simulate a lot of movement.
Yeah. I have seen, back to your point of going larger, I have seen a trend start here, particularly in the Rocky Mountain West. So, you know, from Arizona, New Mexico, clear up to Montana and Idaho, that bigger flies are coming back into vogue.
Mm-hmm.
Versus fishing small micro stuff. And that's kind of good for me as I get older, is to see those little guys. Like that trend.
Well, and the other reason for that too is there's stoneflies, for example, are a great example of this. They have multi-year life cycles. So a stonefly that's hatching this year has been in the stream 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
So even though the big stoneflies have hatched, you know, that are in the sizes 6 to 8 range, there's the generation right behind them that's running a size 12 to 14.
Yeah.
And they're going to grow the rest of this year to hatch next year. And so if you're looking at far as like the biggest bug in the river right now, it's still the stoneflies. And yeah. So there's some good stoneflies. So that'd be another fly I'd consider putting on as a point fly.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, so the moraine is about 8,500 feet or so. You know, it's relatively low. It's the first thing you come to when mm-hmm. you come in the park. And we've got actually a couple of moraines. One is named Moraine Park.
Yes.
We've got Hollowell and got the Fall River Valley on the northern entrance to the park.
Mm-hmm.
As you go up in elevation, 9,000-10,000 feet, and you see those streams along the side of the trail before you get to the lakes, which are around 9,500-10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
How do you fish those? How do you fish those different than fishing the moraine?
In those situations, I start dropping out more of the stonefly type patterns, even though there is big stoneflies up there. And I switch to I start cycling patterns that are closer to a 16-14 as a point fly, hackled flies and things like that. And the reason being is that the kind of more predominant bug up there are the clinger mayflies. They're capable and designed to live in that faster water, and they can grip those rocks very well.
Yeah.
But part of their activity is they do have to move around to get their food. And every now and then they're going to make a misstep.
Yeah.
And they have very distinct legs. They have gills that run up and down their body. And when you're looking at these flies, they wiggle and move. And so I pick a pattern right about that size. And again, Oliver Brown colored, even kind of a rusty color. There's some kind of reddish tones
mm-hmm.
that they get. And that's kind of my starting point, and then I'll drop a midge pattern or some wormy pattern off the back, some other nice just general attractor
uh-huh.
attractor pattern.
Yep. So now you're going to get up to those lakes, which the streams are flowing from, usually. How would you fish a high mountain lake?
At that point, I really, this is where I tend to move to closer to a dry fly situation. There's just something about being up there in the clear water and in those glacier carved valleys, and it's just wonderful. And with the clear water, just putting on something like a size 18 Adams, 16 Ant, those kind of patterns, to imitate those mayflies is a good idea. And then I'll tend to drop a small midge off the back.
Yeah,
because there's some great populations of midges up there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do you see a difference between the western side of the park versus the eastern side of the park?
As far as bug populations go, no. And that's one of the things I think maybe as fly fishermen we sometimes need to get over a little bit, is just because one side's more famous for something than the other, or one location in a state is more famous than the other. The bugs don't know that they're supposed to be in a famous river or not a famous river. And so you can take your knowledge. If you fish one stream in the park, you can usually transfer that knowledge to another stream you fish.
Yeah.
So if you're up here for a week and, you know, on your family vacation, and you're going to be hitting a lot of different sections of the park, if you find a fly that's working very well on one stream, you know, chances are, you know, just like you do with your little ant pattern or some other pattern, that fly is going to continue to work on the other streams.
Yeah. And likewise, when they come out to visit Rocky Mountain National Park, they being the visitors that listen to the podcast here, if they go visit other places in the West, let's say they're going to go visit Yellowstone too, for that matter. The bugs are pretty much the same in Yellowstone too. Now the timing of the hatches might be different
right.
due to weather situations, but that all translates equally well, the learnings that you had on one stream to another. So that's a great point that you brought up. So you've just mentioned a bunch of bugs.
Yes.
And variations thereof throughout all the seasons, which could easily add up to 50 different patterns. So I don't think we want to scare our listeners, but what do you just typically take in your fly box? You know, we don't carry a lot.
No.
What do you stock your fly box with?
I stock my fly box with my what I call my confidence patterns. And with the diversity of the bugs, you can pick your favorites. I like pheasant tails. In your book, you have Frank's Flashy, which is kind of a variation of a pheasant tail.
Yeah.
And I have found that fly very effective. It's it's a great imitation of almost everything. So it's very buggy, very good. I think a pattern that you're familiar with, Steve, the Taboo Caddis.
Yeah, I think I'm familiar with that.
Is another great one. Hare's ears, pheasant tails, you know, your standard patterns are great producers in the park. If I am taking someone along and I really want to get them into fish, I'll fish a brightly colored fly just to give the fish something to look at. And I think sometimes those brightly colored flies just grab their attention and they can't resist.
Yeah.
Especially some aquatic pink long thing. And if you really want to know what that is, listen to the previous podcast.
right.
As far as nymphs go, those are my classics. I'll also carry a couple of rubber leg stoneflies. Just because fishing a small stream with a size 14 stone is just such an unusual experience than catching a fish on it. That's just good fun. The used to be for my emerger pattern. Another classic. Used to be emerger.
Yes.
That one makes a lot of rotations in my box. I can never seem to land on a midge pattern, so I've probably got, I don't know, who knows how many, but you can take your pick on those.
Sure.
As far as dry fly goes, I love stimulators.
Yeah.
And then just the classic parachute Adams.
Yep.
I think if I'm fishing a dry fly, about 90% of my dry fly fishing is those two.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, so you don't need an extensive amount of fly patterns to take up there.
No.
Let's say that someone's going to take up, you know, six or eight patterns of what you just mentioned. What sizes should they be looking for?
16 to 18 in your dry flies is probably the standard.
Yeah.
You can't seem to go wrong with those. Even a 14 And in fact, I think I was just fishing a 14 a little while ago. So 14 to 18.
Yeah.
And if you're having trouble keeping track of your fly on the water, pull out that size 14. You'll see fine. Yeah. Stimulators are great.
Well, the park does have a reputation for having fish that are easy to catch, too. And mm-hmm. I personally believe it's due to two factors. One, there's an overabundance of brook trout in the park, which typically, as a species, are more eager to take a fly than mm-hmm. other species that are more critical to a fly. And then secondly, a short growing season forces the trout into feeding when the opportunity exists. And the opportunity is very short summer.
Right.
And so those two combinations make fishing in the park.
Well, and I would add in, too, that the diverse bug population makes a difference. Just because they're not hatching, I mean, we've covered a lot of different ones, all those nymphs are active year-round. So if you're a trout sitting on the bottom eating that 90% of your food, you're seeing caddis, stones, midges, mayflies, everything is coming at you in several different sizes.
Yep.
And probably the most average size is about a 16, 14 fly, especially during the summer.
Yeah.
So that's why that can contribute to your success.
Yeah. Well, you collect bugs too.
My Frankenstein lab.
And I have yet to see that collection, but I've heard about it, and you've shared some vials with us at the fly shop or mm-hmm. some event over the course of time. And you've kind of come up with an innovative way to preserve those bugs and multiply them so that other tires can see them. Tell us a little bit about your tires tile.
The tires tile, this was kind of a random thought out of last year. I noticed, and in talking to even a lot of experienced fly fishermen, don't see a lot of these bugs. And so one of the goals I had kind of simmering in the back of my mind was, okay, how can I get bugs into people's hands, and how can you do this, you know, where you don't have to have a crazy lab like I do with things floating in vials and, you know, having to put up with, you know, just the mess that is. And I eventually came up with a way to create a mold of the insect. And so the first series out right now is a stonefly series. And that series covers all the stoneflies in a way you'll see in the park. It's got the salmon fly, the golden stone, squalus stone, and then a small golden and salmon fly, which will be pretty much constant year-round, pretty much anywhere in Colorado or where those bugs exist. And it's a... just short of 2-inch tile, and there's the 3D mold of the bug. That you can sit at your desk, you can hold it up to your fly, you can get your proportions, and, you know, just, you can really, you know, use it to model a fly.
Absolutely.
It's the goal.
And you gave me a set early on in its mm-hmm. production life cycle, and I have it sitting in my top drawer of my tying desk here. But earlier this spring, I was tying up some stone flies using the new Chewy Skin mm-hmm. Material, which I find to be very effective for a stone fly body. And I used your tiles to make sure I was getting the abdomen details right. And just kind of, without putting too much extra effort into building a fly, can I imitate with materials the features that are on these flies? And things I started to notice were the heavy segmentation mm-hmm. on a stone fly body. And how big and flat its head is with these big bulbous eyeballs, which, what you just said, many fly fishers and fly tires like myself don't see these bugs day in and day out, so you don't know those details. But I'm starting to build those details into my flies without too much extra effort.
Well, no, and it's even just doing something like going, wow, those legs really are prominent. I mean, that's why those guys are getting really good strikes on rubber leg flies, or why I need to make sure that that's a distinct visual cue for the fish.
So I think these tiles are a really wonderful addition to the avid fly tire. Now, they're probably not for everyone, but certainly as part of this podcast, I'll put some pictures up on the website next to the link so that people can see what these look like. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the mayfly and the caddisfly set as they come out too.
Oh yeah, I'm excited to get in the water and start catching some bugs here. So yeah. Those will be a fun one to make. So
yeah, and just as a public service announcement, you can find the tires, tiles, and videos that Josh does for us every couple weeks or so throughout the fishing season on RockyMountainFlyFisher.com. Spelled just as I pronounced it.
Yes. And if you look back at the video archives, you can actually catch some video of our host here.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, I think we really covered entomology in the park really well, and I appreciate the tips and tidbits you gave us. Certainly, I think you've opened our eyes into looking at fishing bugs year-round in a different way in the park. Really appreciate having you on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. Yeah. And I hope everybody out there goes to the park and just goes with some confidence that knowing that your fly on the end of your line probably looks like something the fish are eating. So go out there with some confidence and just bring them in.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks again, Josh, for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Steve.
If you have questions or need more information about today's podcast, email me by going to flyfishingrmnp.com and click on the contact link. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Where was I? As far as stoneflies go, that pretty much covers the range of what you're going to see for hatching fish.